Hey, it's Greg Gutfeld. This is The One. That's me, by the way. If you ever wonder who The One is, it's me. Another exciting guest. I only have exciting guests. There are people who interest me. This guy, his name's Mark Perry. He's a professor of finance and business economics. He's in the School of Management at the Flint campus of the University of Michigan. He's a teacher. He's held joint appointments at the American Enterprise Institute in D.C. As a visiting scholar. He holds a bunch of degrees. But he's his area of research, and this is why it's strange, because I don't know jack about economics, but his primary research is in the area of applied macroeconomics and financial economics. And I'm always interested in what he's writing about and what he has to say, which says something about how economics is taught these days that maybe it needs to change, because he makes it interesting. And normally it's something that would bore me to tears. He's one of these guys. First of all, Professor Perry, how are you?
Yeah, very good, Greg. Happy to be on your show.
Thank you. You're one of those guys who, I will admit, makes me appear smarter, because I go onto your Twitter feed and I find the things that you post or write about. And essentially what you do is you dispute common assumptions about gender, wage rates, and you find these great facts every day. And then I get to repeat them. Sometimes I'll cite you. I will admit that it's not from me, but it's interesting. You come up with so much good stuff. So I'm curious, first off, about what you read. What do you read every day?
Well, I read a number of economic blogs, including Marginal Revolution and Cafe Hayek. And, you know, because I've been blogging now for more than 10 years, I have a little network of people who feed me stuff almost every day. So I've been fortunate to have five or six people that also read a lot of economics and blogs and finance. And so I've got all these different sources, these spies out there who feed me stuff, and it really helps me to be more productive on Twitter and write more things on my blog. So, you know, I'm just always, and I follow Twitter, I follow you, I have Twitter envy because you have so many followers, almost a million now.
They're all bots.
Yeah.
I'm kidding.
So I follow a lot of people on Twitter and, you know, follow the Cato Institute and follow other people at AEI, Christina Summers.
Yes.
So I just try to have a big kind of network out there of people and blogs and websites that I go to. It's just overwhelming sometimes, but, you know, and then I collect a lot of data, like you say, from different government websites or different sources that I can find. So I've kind of specialized, like you say, in a data-driven approach to trying to debunk a lot of the myths that are out there. And so that's kind of a lifetime job to do that. But so I do it every day and have been pretty successful. And I think because I have a lot of graphs and charts and tables and figures, it makes it visually interesting on the blog. And I share a lot of those on Twitter as well. So that's kind of been my specialty. I do Venn diagrams now quite often to expose liberal hypocrisy. And so that's kind of where it's at right now for me.
I think that's the key point, that you use a lot of interesting windows to get people into challenging ideas, like the Venn diagrams and your charts, which I love. So I guess my original convoluted question was, a comment and a question, you tend to make economic ideas understandable. And for me, I was always terrible at this stuff. So my question is it the way economics is taught that makes average Americans so economically challenged? Why we don't understand taxes, why we don't understand big government debt, or Johnny Depp, or deficits? Is it because we're just not being taught it in a way that's understandable?
Well, you know, I think there's been an increasing amount of economic education. Like, I'm old enough to remember when I don't think I really had a choice to study economics in high school, and that's now being much more common, or I think some states might even require it. It's, at Harvard, Greg Mankiw always talks about how it's the number one most popular class at all of Harvard University. So I think people are getting exposed to it in a way that they should be able to understand it. It's really not that that difficult. That's what appealed to me about it, is that it seems like there's this consistent flow of logic and a framework of analysis that makes it pretty easy to help understand things like the minimum wage or the trade deficit or the pay gap. So, I mean, it appealed to me immediately, and I guess I kind of maybe learned from the master, because I grew up studying Milton Friedman, and he was kind of my guru in terms of, you know, and towards the end of his career, he kind of specialized in, he had a Newsweek column, I think, for 10 years. He wrote Free to Choose. He had a video series based on Free to Choose. So that's kind of the gold standard, I think, of being able to take what might be fairly complicated, convoluted economic issues and topics, but being able to then break it down in a way that you can explain it to a general audience. And that's what I try to do on my blog, is just really cover a lot of different topics. I don't specialize in anything like most other people at AEI. So I think attracted this broad audience because people like to help. They'd like to get help they like to get help understanding economics. I try to do that in a visually appealing way that's fun and uses a lot of graphs.
You will find a story that I never heard of, but it's just so striking. You tweeted about a toll on I-66, a toll that you pay on I-66. Why did you bring this up?
Well, because that's often, again, something that people don't understand. You know, there's this outrage always about ticket scalping. I just talked to, Hamilton's going out to Denver, so it's a big issue out there. When Uber or Lyft, when they do surge pricing, you know, people get all outraged. Mm-hmm. And so that was just an example of how they're using dynamic market-based pricing to allocate scarce space on that I-66 freeway that's coming into town in the morning.
Yeah.
And, you know, it used to be high occupancy vehicles, so you couldn't use it unless you had either two or three people in the car.
Right.
Now, I guess they added an extra lane. So now you can be by yourself and you have a choice. So you don't have to pay that. But if it's important for you to get into town in a efficient way, and save some time, then people are, if they're willing to pay $42 or $46, then
Isn't that amazing, though? Like, the toll is over $40? For how much road is that? I mean, like, when I saw that, I was like, there's a toll road that you have to pay 40-something bucks for? But, I mean, if the market will bear that, but, I mean, it's pretty high.
Well, it is, and they did mention that was a Washington Post article, and they did mention that was just shy of the all-time record, which is a dollar or two more than that $47.
Jeez, Louise.
But, you know, yeah, it's from the Beltway, I think, into the city on I-66, so maybe it's a stretch of about 10 miles.
Is that amazing?
Like that.
A toll. Now, also, I got to ask you, there was another great statistic about the it was about the shortage of U-Haul trucks in the Bay Area, you know, leaving Silicon Valley. And explain – you find these stats and they tell a story. What is the story behind these U-Haul trucks?
Yeah, well, if you think of U-Haul as a national company and they have trucks all over the country and people are moving from one city to another. So ideally, from U-Haul's standpoint, they would like an equal number of trucks going in each direction between two major cities, like, let's say, San Francisco and Houston, because then there's a balance and then they have inventory of trucks on both sides when they need them for customers. But what's been happening is everybody's leaving California for places like Phoenix and for Nashville and for Houston. And so you have a lot of trucks leaving California that end up in, let's say, in Texas, but then not very many trucks going back in the opposite direction.
Right.
So they have too many trucks in Texas and not enough in California. So what they do, I mean, I've never talked to them, but it just seems when you look at their one-way truck rental rates for a 26-foot truck, and then I think what was it like, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 going from, I don't know, California to Texas, and then they had some of them priced going back in the opposite direction at only about $100.
Yeah.
So it's almost like they're subsidizing or paying people to get the trucks back, and so they just price it again based on relative demand. And so when you have a scarcity of trucks and high demand in San Jose, they price them really high. When you have a oversupply or an abundance of trucks with low demand in places like Texas, then they price them at a very low rate to go out to California.
So I mean, but the story is a lot of people are leaving California, right? They're leaving California because it's Even people like me, I mean, I left California. It's almost impossible to live there for a lot of people, right?
Well, it is, especially in the bigger cities, because of the housing costs are so high, and, you know, because they've restricted land use and restricted development, and there's so many zoning ordinances, so they've restricted the supply of housing, and then they somehow wonder why it's so expensive to live there. And so actually, one of the big moving companies, North American United or North American Van Lines, they did an annual study, and they showed that for the first time since they've been tracking these annual data, that there was California became an outbound state for the first, or made it into the top five outbound states. And so people are leaving the state. That article that was written recently was about more like the San Jose, Silicon Valley area. But yeah, and then, you know, they say that once you adjust for the cost of living, California is now the poverty capital of America.
Amazing.
Yeah, because that's once they take into account things like not just your income, but how much does it cost to live there? What's the cost of housing? What's the cost of energy? What are your taxes? And so it's really, I think, a state that's now unattractive to businesses and unattractive to residents. And so there's been a lot of stories about the out migration from California and San Jose area and San Francisco to places like Oregon, Idaho, Tennessee, Memphis, Nashville, Houston, Dallas, Austin, Phoenix, places like that where housing costs are very low. There's a lot of jobs. Taxes are lower. It's more business friendly. And so it's a great kind of experiment in a way. It's a laboratory experiment of 50 states competing among one another to get residents and businesses.
No, that's so true. You know, there's another interesting piece of data that I think you tweeted. It was about the Walmart. It's about they had a profit of margin, I guess it was 2.1%. And you broke this down and it said that all revenues during the first 357 days or 51 weeks go to cover costs like labor, merchandise, utilities, and taxes. And then finally, the sales during the final 8 days of the year would be profit. And I don't think people – I mean, when you put it that way, it's like everybody thinks that these are these giant evil corporations. But you realize that for 51 of 52 weeks, they're just staying even, correct?
Well, that's right. In fact, I think I had reported some polling that's been done, some survey data where they show the average person, if they ask them what does an average corporation in the United States make in terms of its profit margin, and most people think it's 30 or 40%,
mm-hmm.
when really the average is somewhere more like 7 or 8, and in retail it's more like 2 or 3, and actually in grocery stores and supermarkets it's more like 1. And so that's why I think now that Walmart is becoming more of a, you know, I think more than half of their sales are food now. They're becoming more of a supermarket for food. I think that their profit margins have gone down from 3 or 4% down to 1 or 2%. And then when you think of how little that is, 1 or 2%, let's say for a restaurant or for a retailer, Best Buy, Home Depot, it's pretty easy to go from 1 to 2% to zero or go negative if you don't really manage and control your costs, because that's just so important. You're operating on razor thin margins.
Yep.
And so it's pretty easy if you don't control your cost to go from 1 or 2% to zero and then go negative. So, yeah, people don't understand that at all.
No, it's not. And it makes it easy for, you know, celebrities who can make $4 or $5 million a picture to rail against capitalism. They have no idea what a risky endeavor capitalism is for the people who engage in it. That, you know, you got to put in a lot just to make a little, and no one talks about that. I want to move on to politics because I don't really know. I'll give you my theory on Trump, and I want to get how you – what's your sense of what he's been doing so far? I always look at him as somebody he's performed kind of like a belly flop in a swimming pool of ideology. So, you know, everybody's kind of confused on where they are. So right now you have Democrats – who are cold warriors and deficit hawks, and you have Republicans who are kind of saying, hey, the Russians, you know, got to keep an eye on them, but they're not that bad, and they're now for a big spending. It seems like everything shifted under Trump. Am I wrong?
Well, yeah, I mean, he's turned Washington upside down in a lot of ways, and he's so unpredictable. I mean, he doesn't have a consistent political philosophy
right.
or ideology. So, I mean, in a way, it's kind of refreshing because somebody like Bernie Sanders or even Paul Ryan, they might be pretty perfectly predictable. But now you've got someone who's kind of turned everything upside down. People don't know what to expect. I think overall, he's done a good job. I think his appointments and his policies in like education, energy, Israel, regulations, Supreme Court nomination, everything except for taxes. He's been a little bit more on the pro-business side. I think people have more trust and confidence, yeah. And then thinking what it would be like if Hillary Clinton was president mm-hmm. right now. But the only weak area that I don't agree with him on, of course, is international trade.
Right.
He's a little bit of a protectionist. And so he might be coming around a little bit, but that's, I think, his weak area from an economic standpoint is his kind of, well, the Wall Street Journal called him the first authentic protectionist in the White House since the 1920s. So we have to be a little concerned or nervous about where he's going with trade. He just imposed, the tariffs on solar panels and washing machines mm-hmm. and wants to get out of NAFTA, backed out of the TPP. So, hopefully he'll get some better advice or kind of come around on trade, because if he went really off in the protectionist area, that agenda that he seemed to be promoting when he was running for office, I think that would be, a real disaster for the U.S. and the rest of the world.
Yeah, I was frustrated watching people that I know who are conservative cheering, like, we're getting out of TPP. And I think that was based on the assumption that nobody knows what – none of these people have even heard TPP before. But, yay, we're getting out of this thing. And it's like – but I want to ask you, was there any detrimental effect – because, I think he would – like, Trump was right to pull out of one agreement, the climate accord. I think that was really smart. So is he using a consistent opinion where he's saying, like, I like deals, but they got to be good deals, and TPP was a bad deal, the climate accord, Paris Accord was a bad deal, or is he inconsistent on this, and it's just like, I don't know, I'm trying to make heads or tails over, like, if he's just wants better deals, or he's protectionist. Do you know what I mean?
Well, it is kind of hard to figure out, and I kind of agreed with him on the climate deal, getting out of that, because actually people don't even realize this either. We have lower carbon emissions in the United States now than we have had for like 20 years. It's at a 20-year low, and everybody, you hear all this hysteria as if it's getting worse and worse. But in terms of reduction of greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, I mean, the U.S. has kind of been one of the world's leader in that area. But on the trade deal, I guess when you get into those agreements, they get very, you have 1,000 pages. And so then, of course, there's all these cutouts and carve outs, and certain industries want certain protections. So, I mean, maybe he's got some legitimate reasons to not, for backing out of that deal. But I think his biggest flaw, and if you hear him talk about trade, he talks about U.S. companies, U.S. exports, and U.S. jobs. The one group he never talks about, which is the most important group, that's U.S. consumers. Mm-hmm. He never says, well, how are U.S. consumers going to benefit from NAFTA or from, trade with China? He only talks about protecting American producers.
Right.
And so I think we really always have to look at trade issues through the viewpoint of the consumer. So if you think of washing machines from Korea, from Samsung and LG, or solar panels from China, consumers obviously better from lower prices, more competition, more choice, less restrictions on trade. And so in terms of how consumers make out on deals like that, they're always going to be kind of coming out behind, and then the U.S. producers are the ones that always want protection because, of course, they always want to be insulated and protected from competition. In an ideal world for Whirlpool, they'd like to be the only producer of washing machines in the world. They'd love to be a monopolist because then they'd have market power. But from a consumer standpoint, and that's what Trump misses, we always have to think of how is this going to affect consumers. He talks about imposing tariffs on Samsung or on Korea, but it's the consumers that pay the tariffs. It's U.S. people who pay the tariffs, either the companies or consumers, in the form of higher prices. So then it's like you're imposing taxes and tariffs on yourself, and that's why it's kind of a form of economic suicide and why really we have to think about what's best for the consumer. So maybe if Trump wants to protect the U.S. consumer, but it seems like most of what he wants to do is protect U.S. producers from somehow unfair competition or subsidies from that their competitors get. But I'm all for subsidies if it helps lower prices for American consumers.
Yeah, I kind of feel that. I feel the same way, and I kind of feel that way when we talk about immigration as well. That what kind of choices hurt the consumer? We don't talk about that. I don't have much time left, and I have like about 15 questions. I want to talk. Okay, last question. Should I be worried? Should we be worried about artificial intelligence? Because I see two sides of this where people are saying that we're headed towards, you know, human slavery before the metallic non-conscious thinking or the non-conscious thinking machine gods. Or, no, we could just pull the plug. Everything's fine. Where do you sit? Are you an optimist in the whole world of artificial intelligence?
Well, yeah, you know, I haven't really covered that really closely. I'm generally aware of it, but it just seems like maybe it's the skepticism that is just natural for any kind of new technology going back throughout history, whether it's, you know, sewing machines, putting some people out of work or robots or whatever it is. So, you know, I'm pretty much of an optimist. You know, I think that we have to really allow for innovation and creativity and entrepreneurship. This is a perfect example of that. I don't think it's going to really, you know, put people out of work permanently in the long run, just like innovations in other industries like farming. You know, you might reduce jobs in one area, but then you free up resources and human power for other areas. So I think I'm optimistic about the future for all technologies, including artificial intelligence.
I have one last question and then let you go. I feel like we were talking about monopolists, and I feel like Google is getting a free ride when I see – like when I see something like YouTube and how little musicians are getting paid these days for their songs, and half of all music now is people are just taking it from YouTube. It's killing. I think it's like Google is seen as cool, but it's actually hurting. I think it's hurting a lot of musicians or people who need money. And do you think Google is doing good or bad?
Well, I think overall it's good. There might be some areas like you're talking about with musicians not getting royalties. I know that's been a concern for a while. But it just seems like as long as they're not being protected, as long as they're not a coercive monopoly and they are not receiving, you know, government help to prevent competitors from entering, that if it ever gets that they have too much power or they turn anti-consumer, as long as there's other web browsers or other tech companies that could go in and challenge them, then I think that'll kind of work itself out. So I think market competition is always the best regulator in the long run, not government bureaucrats.
All right, Professor Perry, where can people find you? You have a blog, right?
Yeah, the name of the blog is Carpe Diem. It's hosted by American Enterprise Institute. So if you just do a Google search for if you do a search for Carpe Diem or Carpe Diem blog, you'll see I've got some stuff up for Valentine's Day. I try to have new content every day. And then they can follow me on Twitter through, you know, Mark J. Perry. And those are the two places that people could find me.
And I have to say, you got to follow him because every day – you get some kind of new angle on stuff that you hear. For somebody like me who does a couple of shows a day or two shows a week, I guess, to try to find a different angle on the stuff that is constantly being churned out, you always have some kind of inventive or I mean it's statistically based information that is somehow ignored on TV. Professor Perry, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Greg. Happy to be on your show.